Hi, and welcome back to Ordinarily Extraordinary Conversations with Women in STEM. I'm so glad that you can join me today. Honestly, this podcast has been one of the best things that I have done, and I just love the people that I get to talk to and bringing community to everyone out there. And so I'm so grateful to have you listening to this podcast. So thank you so much. I am really excited about today's guest. Today's guest is Kathy Ford. She is the Chief Operating Officer at Cura Oncology, a biopharmaceutical company working towards treatment and curing cancer. She's been in the medical field for a very long time. She started out as an ICU nurse in the 1960s. We have a really fun conversation about how the work world has changed over the past few decades. She has a really interesting career path from nursing to being a stay-at-home mom, and then going back to work in clinical research and eventually into executive leadership in biotech. I just really, really enjoyed my conversation with her, and I'm so delighted to be able to share her story with you all. I hope you enjoy her story. Thank you, Kathy, for joining me on the podcast today. I'm so excited to talk with you and learn more about your journey. You've been in the medical industry and the medical field for a very long time, and I'm just excited to hear your story and learn about the journey that you have had. So good morning.
Well, good morning, Kathy. Thank you. It's my pleasure to join and share my experiences with you and your podcast listeners. It's a pleasure.
So let's just jump in. And what do you currently do for a job? What's your current role?
That's a good question, because my title is COO, Chief Operating Officer, and that means different things at different industries and different companies, even within the same industry. So let me break it down a little bit and describe what are the functions, what are the things that I do at Cura Oncology that fall within my remit. So in general, or the way you would probably want to think about it, is that all of the moving pieces, all of the operating pieces are things that I look after. For example, the clinical operations, the data management services, IT, HR. A large group is the clinical manufacturing control, the CMC group. Quality assurance, both CQA as well as the GXP functions within manufacturing. And the contracting and outsourcing group, we are a biotechnology company relying heavily on service providers. Therefore, we have a pretty extensive operating machine around the management of vendors, contracting vendors, et cetera. I oversee all of that. I'm sure there are a couple of other things I've forgotten. But in general, to think of my role as overseeing the engine of the company, so to speak.
So I'm going to ask a question that I think is hard. What is a typical day in your life? And I know it's hard because every day is different, but what would a typical day be? Like, what would you be doing on a day-to-day basis as a COO in a biotech field?
It's a hard question because the answer isn't straightforward, because it changes all of the time, which is why I think you probably crafted the question noting ahead of time that it's a hard one. But let me see if I can give you a sense of what that is. We are not a commercial company yet, hope to be soon, but not quite yet. Therefore, most of the work we do is in the R&D space, and managing the clinical trials is what consumes most of my time, as well as other functional groups. The medical group, the strategic group, program leadership, we're all in the clinical development space because that's where the company is focused right now. So a typical day for me is, given that I oversee the operations of the clinical trials, would be to check in with the folks who manage the trials. We're in the oncology space, so it's a very active, things change a lot during the management of the clinical trials, and we have very close supervision of the administration of our compounds into cancer patients. So I spend a lot of my time checking in with the folks who have more direct connection with those clinical trials. Relatedly, I check in with our CMC folks to make sure that from a supply perspective and the vendors that produce these medicines for us, that all is as expected. And when it's not, what we can do as an intervention that's appropriate. So it's a typical day for me is checking in with the folks that report to me who do the really important work and making sure that everything is running as expected according to plan. And if not, what can I do to help?
I'm curious, what areas of cancer do you guys focus on? Are there certain specific areas that you focus on?
So we have a product, farnesyl transferase inhibitor, that we're looking at in the head and neck cancer space, soon to be looking at other cancers as well. These are targeted therapies, so we look for those cancers that most fit the target profile that we're looking to reach to help stop cancer growth. So it's head and neck, and the other most advanced product that we have is focused on hematologic cancers, leukemias, or AML to be more specific. So as you probably would guess, these are very desperate cancers, very uniformly lethal, and the urgency to get medicines to these patients is felt by every employee at Cora and the investigators and patients and families that we engage to help us with this research. There's a sense of urgency in what we do.
Yeah, and honestly, like that was one of the things that like intrigued me about talking with you because I think I may have mentioned this when we had our initial conversation. My son was diagnosed with thyroid cancer at 13, which is not a very lethal cancer. I mean, he's doing fine, he's clean, but as a parent of someone being diagnosed with cancer, it was a very scary time. And I had no idea. I didn't know anything about thyroid cancer, nothing. And it's such a scary thing to go through. The cancer word is just terrifying. I don't know if it's less terrifying when it's you than it is your kid. I don't know. It was a really scary time. And I don't want to say I spend a lot of time, but I have a different viewpoint having gone through that of just like, I want to say like, maybe I have like this tiny little glimpse into what either parents or people go through when they have very terminal cancers or very lethal cancers and they're getting that diagnosis and stuff. And it's work that I think is so incredibly important. And I'm curious if you going to work in this space, was there something that drew you to enter into this space, or is it something that you have just went into, or how did you end up going into the oncology world?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And let me just say, as a parent with a child, I can only imagine what it was like to hear that diagnosis and not having any touchstone or background information or anything you could draw from when you hear that. It is terrifying. The cancer word is terrifying and always has been. And our work, if we are successful, our work is to make sure that we deliver medicines, at least in our space, we deliver medicines that will make the cancer word less terrifying, because we will have found something that allows us to manage the disease in a better way. But it is uniformly terrifying to hear that. For yourself, I think probably worse for your child. I was in pediatric glioblastoma earlier in my career, and one of the most devastating diseases for children. And it was such a profound experience for me. So again, from an empathetic standpoint, as I worked with the parents as well as the children, I understand that. So what drew me to oncology? So it's interesting. Once you make the decision to work in drug development, it's not difficult to focus on oncology, because far and away, the most clinical trials currently in the United States and probably the world is in oncology. So just by virtue of the fact of sheer numbers, you're likely to fall into the oncology space as a drug developer. So that's how I got in there.
Okay. So you started out your career as an ICU nurse in the 1960s.
Yes.
Do you want to maybe share about what your experience was like at that time, being in the medical field? And I mean, nursing has always been predominantly female, but I'm curious about just being in the medical industry itself. Like, did you ever consider becoming a doctor? And was that something that you couldn't do because you were female or anything like that? And then if you want to just like walk us through your career journey as you went into these different areas and what made you decide to have the journey that you had. Or I also think that sometimes life just takes you on a path that you could like just go on, and it's not necessarily something you plan. You just end up there. Tell me about your journey.
Yeah, so it's a little bit of all of that, of course. Thank you for that question about what was it like in the 60s. Very different. Certainly, I'm talking now about the clinical setting. It was very different than it is today. I was just to take this for 1 second off a little bit. I currently have a nephew with a four-month-old who is being treated for a very dicey condition at the Boston Children's Hospital. He has a malformation in the trachea. You know, the trachea has C-shaped rings that give it form, but there's a certain birth defect where those rings, the cartilaginous rings, are actually solid. They're O's instead of C's, which is a very dangerous way to live. In fact, you can't live. You can't grow with that. So he just had surgery at the Children's Hospital in Boston, and he's doing well. It's just 4 days ago. He's very stable, doing well. But the reason I bring that in is I've just recently, within the last week, been in the medical setting and could compare it to what it was like, your question, in the 60s to how it is now. And so different, so different for women, for nurses, for other sort of professions that stand in the ICU with the nurses and the doctors, the traditional caregivers, but the respiratory therapists and all of the GI folks, et cetera. The teamwork that is evidenced in the current clinical critical care setting is so much more, it's just better. It's so much more collegial. It's almost like a ballet, watching the nurses, the doctors, and the other folks in the room manage those critically ill patients, in this case, a tiny baby. Not so much when I was in the 60s. It was a little more functionally divided, the physicians having a certain set of roles and presence. The nurses were very obviously critical to the care of the patients, but there was a different level of who does what, and with less even respectfulness across the board. I tell the story, and I think folks, younger, particularly younger women, think that I may exaggerate for a little drama. In fact, it's true. At the Mass General, which is where I was nursing, if you were sitting in the nurse's station and a physician walked in, it was expected that you would stand up and give him your seat. And it just reflected a societal way that women, particularly women who were in the helping professions, that was the behavioral expectation, that the physicians had this level of respect and seniority and importance, and others. And keep in mind, Kathy, nobody was complaining about this. It just was the way it was, right? So things have changed tremendously in that amount of time, for the good of the patient. Importantly, not necessarily for the good of the nurses, or the doctors, or anyone else, but for the good of the patients, that it's a much more equitable division of labor and partnership, as you see reflected in society and in other areas as well.
So how did your career path progress from being an ICU nurse to where you are now? Like, what was that journey like for you?
Yeah, thank you for that. So it's interesting. I've listened to a couple of your podcasts. I love the format. I love the way you do this and calling it ordinary and extraordinary in the same breath, in the same sort of description of what it is you do, because we are ordinary people doing extraordinary things. We women, whether we're doing STEM work or whether we're doing other work, we are ordinary and extraordinary. And we don't often take time to recognize that about ourselves. And every woman, wherever they are in their career, from a college student to much older, we are ordinary, extraordinary people, human beings.
Absolutely.
Thanks for that. So how did my career go? So I did my ICU nursing in a variety of different places as I got married and we moved to different areas. Once I started having children, I have three children, and once I started having kids, I worked shift work so we could share the responsibility for childcare, and then it just got too big, and my husband traveled so much that I needed to stay home, and was fortunate and happy to stay home while the kids were little. So when I went back to work, I knew that I didn't want to go back to doing what I did, particularly around the schedules. It was the big blocker for me was having to rotate schedules. No matter where you were in nursing, if you were going to be in critical care, whether you were at the supervisory level or at the entry level, you were going to rotate shifts. And my life and my family didn't accommodate that. So I looked for something, different, and actually responded to an ad for a nurse that were specifically looking for nurses to work in the CRO business, CRO standing for Contract Research Organization. And in this case, this was a company that would manage the clinical trials and monitor the data at the various hospitals and physicians' offices in under contract with one of the pharma or biopharma organizations. So, and that allowed me to be part-time, to make my own schedule, to go out and monitor the data. So that's how I entered the field. I did that for about 5 years. And at this point, my kids were getting into high school and all of that. So I was able, and they all played sports, which was crazy. So to a couple of your guests, and you'd look at your calendar. You had to be in two places in two different fields at the same time. All of the things that we women and mothers deal with. So having a part-time job and managing my schedule worked with my family. My husband traveled a lot as well. So I did that and then decided when my last child, my daughter, finished high school, went off to college, that I would actually take a position and work full-time and actually start my career in this clinical research business. And I was fortunate enough to be offered an opportunity as the first person into the clinical operations. I was actually a second or third employee in the development organization for a biotech company in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So I had a terrific opportunity to take what I had learned in the CRO and then build and grow my own clinical operations department with CRAs, clinical trial leaders, all of the pieces without getting into boring detail, but all of the pieces and all of the functions that you need to actually run clinical trials. So I did that for 10 years. In that company. It was a fabulous company, wonderful people, but really saw at the same time there was tremendous growth in the drug development space. If you remember the AIDS epidemic and the regulatory environment that allowed now more rapid and more creative ways to get drugs approved, allowed for innovation in how we did this. And I was in a position of sort of an ability to actually control some of that within the company and take advantage of some of the opportunities to do things new and in a new way, unlike some of the larger pharma companies, which really they're embedded in a big engine and they can't turn a battleship in a bathtub, as they say. So we were nimble enough to be able to do that. And I was fortunate enough to work with terrific mentors, women and men, to help me learn this and to do it and to achieve some success there. From there, I went on and then the career goes forward. I took a VP role at another biotechnology company and another company. It was a European-based company. So my husband and I moved to Europe for 3 years and I worked out of Germany and came back and interestingly thought I would be retiring. And I was attracted by the pull of this amazing company I work for now and couldn't say no and just loving every minute of what I do. So, yeah.
So when did you decide to stay home? And I'm curious because I think it's really interesting how much maternity leave policies have changed. So I'm curious about like what your experience was like finding out that you were pregnant, telling your company that you were pregnant, maternity leave, making the decision to stay at home, because I don't know, maybe that was an easier decision in the 1960s. I don't know. What was that experience like for you?
So I should say it was the 70s, actually. I'm okay. Old enough. Quite that old, so yes.
Okay. Sorry. You said you started in the 1960s, so that was my bad. So my bad on that. In the 1970s.
Yeah. So it's interesting that you asked that question. What was it like? So, of course, it's not like it is now. There was no such thing as maternity leave. You just left, right? But for me, it was interesting because I was very active. My sister and I were very active in the women's movement. And at that time, we were radicals out in the suburbs talking about the ERA, Equal Rights Amendment, and all
still
of
still waiting for that.
Crazy. Oh, Jesus, please. So, oh, delete that. I didn't mean to say
no,
that.
That's fine. No, that needs that.
So we were activist, not necessarily angry and burning bras or things like that, but it was our expectation that we would have equal opportunities anywhere we wanted to go and for whatever reasons we had, that there should be no blockers to being what we want to be. Mm-hmm. And so to answer your question more directly, when I decided to stay home, I felt guilty. I felt I was letting the movement down. I don't know how to describe it. It was a guilty feeling that I shouldn't be doing that. But I did because my priority was my family. Still is today. My priority is my family.
I think regardless of which way you go, there's guilt.
Yeah.
There's guilt.
Yeah. Nobody ever told me that before I had children, that everything about this is guilt.
You just feel guilty for the rest of your life.
You know, oh, my child got a B. Oh, my God, how did I screw him up? I must have done So anyway, but more to the point, I felt like I shouldn't be staying home. I recognized it as a privilege. I was able to stay home. We were able to. I didn't need to work to put food on the table. But I felt my husband was traveling. I really wanted to be home with my children. I didn't know if I could swing it. Child care is never great. It's available, mm-hmm. but it's not great. It's switching around from this babysitter to that friend to, you know, trying to find ways to get somebody to do the rides. It's complicated and it's stressful. So for me, I just stayed home.
It's hard. It's hard.
Many of the, I have a lot of young women and young moms that work with me and for me. I am amazed at these women, what they are able to accomplish at work, high performing people at work. They go home to their children and they, I'm certain, are outstanding mothers as well. They're better women than I am because I don't know as I could do what they do. They're terrific.
Okay, so there was no maternity leave. So when you made the decision, so did you make that decision like right away? Did you try to work at all? Or did you just like early on just decide like, I'm done and this is what I'm doing?
No, I tried. I worked, you know, 3 to 11 shifts so that I only had interim babysitting needs. When I'd go to work at 2:30, my husband would be home by 6:00. And then I would get home. So I only had late afternoons. And then when the requirement came that I needed to rotate to other shifts, I couldn't work nights and then come home and take care of babies. My husband worked.
Yeah.
So I tried it and couldn't make it work.
Yeah. Well, it's hard for my husband did shift work during the time that we had kids. And I took, well, my first one, I went back to work after 6 weeks, but the second I know it's so ridiculous. Like, thank goodness that most maternity leave policies are better now. And thank goodness that there's paternity leave policies. But the second two, I worked part-time for a year. And so I would work like opposite shifts of him.
Yeah.
And it was always this juggling act of like, who's going to be where. And one of the things that I think is funny, at least for me, was I always said that my husband was a better housewife than I was because like, he would, so on the days that he was home, because he worked like 12-hour shifts, so it would be like opposite days. It wasn't necessarily opposite hours. I would come home, dinner would be on the table, the house would be clean, the kids would be dressed. And on the days that I would be at home, he would come home, dinner's nowhere near on the table, the kids are running around naked, the house is a disaster, but I played with the kids.
No, that is funny. Yeah, sharing.
It's still that way, though. He's still much better at a lot of those things than I am. And thank goodness that. And he was the one going to like he went to Mommy and Me classes, and this was like in the, I don't know, like late 90s, early 2000s. I don't think they're probably called Mommy and Me classes now, but he was. It's so interesting how things have changed, and I think that probably in the last, I don't know, 15, probably in the last 10 to 15 years, they've changed, I think, even more to make it better. I mean, we're nowhere near what the majority of countries are with maternity leave, which I think is crazy. Like, that's a whole nother, I don't even want to say podcast episode. That's a whole nother podcast.
So living in Germany, it's interesting. We observed that not only did companies have on-site childcare, so you could go breastfeed your baby and go back to your desk, but they also had something that probably because of the way we live as a country and we're much more mobile, grandparents had those children. We were stunned. In Europe, people don't work as long as we work. I mean, mm-hmm. they generally retire at between 60 and 65. And they're free and available. And it's a family-oriented, raising children is a family-oriented way to live. And most of those little kids had grandparents taking care of them. And those that didn't had on-site daycare. So yeah, we don't have anything like either one of those things here in the U.S. And I have a daughter and two daughters-in-law, all work. And as you described, Kathy, and I know every woman listening to this podcast actually is probably very jealous of what you describe as your husband with dinner on the table, lace boiling.
I'm very lucky.
Yeah, it's terrific. But you do describe a partnership, and I've seen it with my own family. Just wonderful partnerships in child rearing, house stuff. Yes, there are traditional roles, but for the work that needs to get done, the work product that has to go out the door, it's a partnership. It's a teamwork. And gives me confidence and faith that things are moving so fast and so far in the right direction from what I've seen. It's encouraging and heartfelt. And it's a relief for men as well as women. Given that I'm a mother of two boys and one daughter, it's boys and men as well that need to be freed from some of these stereotypical roles.
Absolutely. And I have women friends whose husbands stay at home. And that's the choice that they make. That's what works for them. I also have a good friend whose husband is a CEO of a very large company. And when I go to visit them, he comes home and is making dinner and playing with his kids on the floor with his kids. And I think that the freedom that, you know, that you talk about with the freedom that we have in our roles, it allows them to be able to be fuller humans and have those connections with their kids and their families in ways that they may not have felt okay to do in the past. I mean, the stereotypical roles are harmful for men and women.
Exactly, Kathy.
So it's great to see changes. They don't happen fast enough. It's frustrating.
Have you been watching, or did you read Lessons in Chemistry?
Oh, I read it and now I'm watching it. So yes, yeah. I have so many thoughts on that. Well, okay. So first of all, like one of the things I talk about a lot is the need to see women in STEM fields in media. So it's great. Like, I love it. It's also heartbreaking to see what she goes through. And I think there are some people who think that's not what women went through at that time. And I am absolutely sure that's what women went through at that time. It's awful. Honestly, I don't really know like what other word to use. Like, I mean, the things that women have had to endure because they're women and from being sexually assaulted to being just the level of, I don't want to say it's not really discrimination, just the level of advantage that men tried to have over women and thinking that they were better or women were worse is just so crazy. And it still exists in some ways. It's better, but it's not where it needs to be.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not the way it is. I'm speaking we in the biotech world, we're somewhat jaded. We live in a little pocket that's not the same around the rest of certainly this country and other countries as well. It's, you know, women are still in the nurturing roles and all of the things related to being a nurturer, and all the limitations on being a nurturer biologically are imposed on us societally. However, I think it's a real problem when we start thinking that women are going to be able to get out to where they should be in the world when you live in the biotech world, because it's much more egalitarian. Women are, I'm looking at our leadership team and our board of directors, we're equally men and women. And happily and proudly, I can say, this wasn't a forced or a mandatory kind of thing. Okay, you need 50% here. It came from where it should come from, and that is, may the best man or woman for the job please rise and we will appoint you. That is where we should be going. In other words, the constraints around what women have lived with in history, but in pharma as well, are being lifted in the newer, younger, more advanced, innovative companies. Now, I don't think if you went to an insurance company or to a more traditional manufacturing organization, you would find the same thing. So I'm mindful that I live in a little protected dome in the biopharma world where women aren't discriminated against, and either from their career perspective or from their ability to have a voice or the ability to be free to say what they want to say and not have to check their thoughts before they say it so that they wouldn't be judged as being too feminine or too womanlike or hormonal or whatever those things were that honestly men used to think and say, as you're seeing in the lessons in chemistry. So I'm mindful that the world I live in is very different from the world that most women live in the workplace.
Well, and I think one of the challenges is it's really hard to know what is happening because you're female, what is happening because you have a difference of opinion with somebody else and you just don't mesh. It's not always very clear when it's like true gender discrimination or if it's something else. Yeah. It's not necessarily that easy to know. And so I think that there's a lot of times that we question what we are feeling, what we are experiencing. Are we, and then there's the whole gaslighting thing that can go on that makes it, that adds even like additional questions. Like, am I just imagining this? Is it just me? And honestly, that's one of the things that I want to do with this podcast, because I think it's really important, especially if you are like one woman in an area that is completely men, right? That happens quite often. I'm an engineer. I'm frequently in meetings that are only men still. And being able to hear other people's experiences so that you can go, yeah, I've experienced that. I am not crazy. I think that's really important. I think that's something that we all need to have, especially when you are in a space where you don't necessarily have a group of other women to be that are in that same space that might be experiencing those same things, because you don't necessarily know.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Kathy. You're spot on with that. When, there's the general comments that we're making overall, but then there are situational environments that you're in where you see a woman being bullied and put down. Is it because this guy is a complete idiot that's putting her down, or is it something about her, or is it the environment that women aren't allowed to have voices or differing opinions? And it's all of those things sometimes, which is why, in my view, I'm very strong supporter of women. And one of the things I like to do most is to grow women in my organization, men as well, but particularly women need more help. They need a hand up. And I'm pretty fearless. You know, I've been in this business for so long, and I've been around for such a long time that there's not much I'm afraid of. And I use my voice when I need to use my voice and help women when I see them in a situation that's difficult for them. And sometimes it means confronting their own inability to speak up, and how do they do that, and what should they do without losing either political capital within the organization or losing their point, which they feel is very important. So that's a good, I would love to see if you do find someone to come and speak on this podcast about giving women the opportunity to hear how some women have overcome that from a situational standpoint. Be very important, particularly for women earlier in their career.
I think there's two things that you said in there that I want to dig into a little bit more. One is women having each other's backs. I think that's so critical, and being able to, especially when women are younger and coming in. Although I will say, like, what I see in my daughters is they are probably a little bit less afraid to speak up than I was when I was their age. But being able to have somebody that is in that organization that has their back and speaks up for them, or just let's use an example of men interrupting a woman in a meeting as an example, having somebody else, whether it's male or female, speak up and say, hey, like, let her finish her point or something like that, when a woman may feel shut down. And secondly, now I'm going to have to like think, as I get older, I like lose my train of thought. So, oh, the second thing that you said was...
That usually happens postpartum. Were you either pre or postpartum here? Were you kind of losing
I'm in menopause. So I think I think it just goes, it just keeps going. Like, there's the pregnancy brain, then there's the postpartum brain. Then there's like, oh my gosh, I have three kids that I got to keep track of their schedules brain. And then you're perimenopausal, then you're menopausal, and then you have dementia. I don't know. The brain is just always challenged. That's what I have figured out since like, probably even like starts back at like puberty. Anyway. Well, and then you start questioning, am I getting early dementia? My mom had dementia for the last 3 years of her life, and now I'm like terrified when I start forgetting things that I'm going to be going down that path to. Okay, so you also mentioned that it's important. So one of the things that I think is important, so we have a lot of programs where we are like women mentoring women or men mentoring women. I think it's also super important for women to mentor men because they need to see women as in roles of power, in roles that are above them, so that they get used to that. I think that's also a really important thing, and that they have like a very well-rounded viewpoint. So I think it's great that we have these programs for mentoring women, but I think we also have to make sure that we have like women mentors for men as well, that you alluded that to that a little bit.
Yes, absolutely. Mentor and grow the men who are within my groups and the women as well. I'm particularly sensitive to the women because I think they need a little more of a helping hand sometimes, particularly the younger ones. But the men, my goodness, I have several men actually that report to me, and they're all fabulous. And they have been either trained appropriately by their mothers or the societal impacts and influences around them. But I find them very open to coaching and counseling and calling them on things that may sound either too aggressive or too off-putting to a woman or to even to another man. That's just sort of leadership training. But your point is very well taken. Leading by example for men and women around how to be empowered and how to feel free to express yourself and listen to others. That's a good point. Again, I said my perspective, and I'd love to hear in another podcast that you, if you can find somebody who comes from a much more male-dominated, less innovated, less youthful environment where newer thoughts about gender roles are predominant. But to take someone from a more traditional organization who's had to deal with these kinds of things situationally and how they've dealt with them and what they would advise people in find themselves in these situations.
I'm chuckling because I have been an engineer in the utility industry for 30 years. I'm not sure that you could find something that is more traditional, more male dominated, and has older men than the utility industry.
Yeah,
that's my world.
So maybe you need to do your own to talk about that.
I mean, there are companies that do really well. I will also say there's a really interesting thing that I found this out early on when I started the podcast, because I do like these like fact checks. The highest number of CEOs in one industry is actually of women CEOs in an industry is actually the utility industry, which surprised me.
Oh my goodness. That's shocking.
It is, but I would say they typically come up through finance or through legal, not through technical areas. I think that's also like for men as well. That's just, I think, like a traditional ladder. But I was shocked, honestly. And there are some fabulous women CEOs, but there is in the utility industry, but there is still very much a male-dominated industry. And it's getting better, but I think it depends on where you are and depends on the company. Like, so there's the industry-wide thing, but then there's also specific companies handle things differently and do things differently. And I think what you said is a good point. I mean, that's where the majority of my contacts are, is in the utility space. So it might be worthwhile having someone come in that's at a pretty progressive company that has been able to make those changes. Because I would be curious to know, like, do they thoughtfully make those changes? Were they organic? And how did that happen? I think that would be interesting to know. Yeah. And what kind of environment are they in? And I will also say it is changing. Because it was older for so long, there is a mass retirement issue within the utility industry. And then young people are coming in. I went from being like by far the youngest person at my utility. I was at a utility for 25 years. I'm not now. I was 22 years old when I started. And then when I left it after 25 years, I was one of the older ones. And I was like, this is weird. Because you like don't necessarily feel like you're older.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah. So
let me ask you this then. Let me, just for my own edification. So in order to be, obviously you did it for 25 years, you were successful. Clearly you're a bright, energetic, problem-solving entrepreneur yourself. Did you find that one of the skills you needed was to either play act or become one of the boys?
Oh, absolutely. When I first started, and I do talk about this on the podcast quite a bit, I very much felt like I had to be one of the guys. I baked cakes. I sewed my own clothes. I would not talk about anything that was feminine that I did when I was at work. There was one other woman engineer when I started, and we were both transplants. We both like went to our company from out of state or out of town. And we became like each other's life raft for our first few years of our career. I took up golf. This is a whole other thing that I talk about, because there are people who will like be like, well, we shouldn't have to golf to be able to like network with the men that we work with. And I'm like, golf is actually fun. And I made great relationships with the technicians that I worked with. Those were actually harder relationships than other engineers that I worked with, because there's always this friction between like technicians and engineers. I had really great friendships with the technicians because I would go golfing with them. And I found it to be not just something that was fun, but it was a way that like I didn't necessarily have to be one of the guys golfing. I could still be myself, but it was a way for me to be on an equal playing field with them. I am very regretful for trying to fit in and to be one of the guys. At the same time, I don't know, 30 years ago, I would have done it any other way. I don't know that there was another way to be. I don't think that exists anymore. I think that young women that I see going into the fields, they are very much more comfortable being themselves. And that's the way that it should be. And I'm not that way. I'm not that way now. I'm very authentic. I think some of that comes with age too. Like, I will speak my mind, to your point. I will speak my mind. I will stand up for people. If people don't like it, that's okay. There's other jobs out there. I will do what feels right to me and what I think is right for the situation or for the person that I am standing up for. But I think some of that comes with age, and some of that comes with having a little bit more political capital within your company. And I'm not so afraid of losing my job for speaking up. I would rather lose my job for speaking up and doing the right thing than being quiet in a situation that is the wrong thing.
Yep. I completely agree. And I think it does. So yes, it does come with seniority in the organization, obviously intrinsic value to the group. So there's less fear, less risk. And it also comes with seasoning or age. But honestly, it also is the person itself, yourself. I mean, you have a moral compass, and you want to do the right thing for people, mm-hmm. small or large. You're driven by doing the right thing.
Yeah, and I mean, and I would say in some cases, you just don't give a shit about the little things anymore. Like
exactly.
it just becomes like less important.
Exactly. Yeah.
So when we were talking, you talked a lot about your family and how important your family is to you and to your life. I know you mentioned that you've got three kids, and when we talked before, you have eight grandkids. Tell me what life is like for you now working and having like the larger family. What is life like for you now from that standpoint, and where do you hope to go from here in your career, and what's next?
So I can tell you, being much more down the road or advanced in life's journey than you, I can tell you that it only gets better. It only gets better. And this isn't trying to make myself feel better by saying these words. It truly does get better. The larger your family gets, the more love, the more opportunity that you have to be with them. This past weekend, I have six grandsons. All of them play football. Two at the college level. Two of my youngest ones are playing peewee football. But I have the opportunity to go do that with them, watch them and enjoy their families, observe my children parenting, which is the ultimate mothering thing. I didn't expect when I thought about being a grandmother. I thought of cute clothes and Christmas presents. And as some people say, which actually offends me, oh, it's nice you can enjoy them and send them home. No, I never felt that. I wanted them to stay with me always. I never wanted them to go home. I've been so fortunate. We have happy, healthy kids. So that is a big part of what I do, is engage with them. I'm fortunate to be in a position to travel around with wherever they are. I have a house on Cape Cod, which happens to be on the beach, which is a natural magnet for everybody to come to me. So it was, in addition to myself enjoying it, there was a method to our madness. Let's go to a place where they'll want to come, right? So they do. I see them there. And then in the wintertime, I live in Florida, and another destination for them to come. So my journey is, how does my work life, which is very full and very rewarding for all of the reasons we talked about before, and my family life is full. As I tell people, I am the luckiest person I know. Life is not perfect for me. I'm an unexpected widow of a few years, so that isn't what was in the plan. But despite that, I am still the luckiest person I know with the opportunities I've had as a woman, as a mother, as a grandmother, and as a patient caregiver.
What are you most proud of in your life, in your career?
In my career?
Well, in both.
Yeah. So there's no question. I'm most proud of I'm most proud of my children. I mean, they've far exceeded anything that either my husband or I had ever achieved as people and parents themselves. For my career, I'm most proud of two things. The drugs, I have had the privilege to be part of their development and then eventual commercialization. So that patients, I mean, I see ads on TV now for drugs that I helped develop and which have changed people's lives. It's the energy that I get from those successes that keeps me going and fulfilled. And also the thrill I have whenever I see anyone that's ever worked for me, either continuing to work for me or has moved on other places, to see them advance in their careers and to think that I had a part in developing them as professionals as well. It's another huge source of pride for me.
What do you hope to do in the future?
Well, hoping not to go down the road that your mother went down, or my mother for that matter. So I'm just hope for continued health. I have a tremendous optimism that the medicines I'm working on now at my current company will go on to make a difference in patients' lives, cancer patients' lives. That is my hope. It is my belief that we're doing all the right things for the medicines as they pass through the various stages of development, and the patients that come into our trials, contributing that I'm looking to just continue doing that. And then when it's time for me to say, okay, let's turn this over to somebody else, I'm going to move on. I will always be involved somehow in this space, either as a consultant, maybe sit on a board, something like that. I will continue to look for opportunities to make a difference for patients, actually.
That's awesome. And I have to say, like, as a mom of a kid who went through cancer, the work that you're doing and that people do in that space is so incredibly important. And I'm so glad that there are people out there that are working on being able to find cures.
Yeah.
And treatment. It's incredibly important. Do you have any advice for girls or young women as they think about what they want to do for careers or just in general advice?
In general advice, it sounds trite, it sounds overdone, but be true to yourself. You don't take a path because you think you should or people are encouraging you to do it. Have a quiet conversation with yourself, multiple conversations with yourself, to make sure it fits with who you are and what you want to do that will make you the bigger, better self that is already inside of you. Often, I'll speak about women at least, there are so many influences, you know, social media. I have two granddaughters and I see what they're living with and being influenced by. And for younger people to understand not just what subjects I'm good at school, so I should do X, or I like helping people, so I should be a nurse, or whatever. Honestly and truly, do a self-assessment. What makes you happy? What do you really like to do? I don't care whether it's completing a jigsaw puzzle or whatever. How can you manipulate the things that give you a charge, that give you energy? How can I make that part of what I want to do for life work so that I can be the best that I am, I can be? A lot of women are in positions, friends, people that I dish with like you. And we talk about some of the older influences that we had in our lives and how we may have taken different paths. And the thing that comes down to, it always comes down to the, what makes you happy about yourself? Not happy because you like the movie you saw, but happy about yourself. It gives you the sense of, oh, I'm pretty good at that. Go with it. Go with it. Trust yourself.
I think that's great advice. I love it. Well, Kathy, I'm so glad that you have been on the podcast, and this has been just a great conversation. I feel like we could talk for like 4 more hours. So thank you so much. And I hope that we can keep in touch. And I just love the work that you're doing. So grateful for that.
Well, thank you, Kathy. Thank you for today, but mostly thank you for what you're doing for women with your podcast. It's been a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Ordinarily Extraordinary Conversations with Women in STEM and Kathy's story. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd like to ask you to do a couple of things which are really important to get these women's stories out to more people and increasing representation of women in STEM. First, please share an episode you like with a friend. Second, please go to your podcast platform that you listen on and rate my podcast. Or even better, if you could write a review, that would be great. And third, subscribe or follow my podcast by going to your podcast platform and click the plus or follow button. That way, you'll never miss an episode. And lastly, you can find me, Kathy Nelson, at www.ordinarily-extraordinary.com or email me at ordinarilyextraordinarypod@gmail.com. You can also find me on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn, where you can find me by searching for my podcast. Please reach out to me. I hope to connect with you. Thank you, and please join me for future episodes.